I'm the Dean of Arts and Sciences, Peter LaPage. This series brings major international policymakers to campus, and our guest today certainly qualifies. He is the Honorable Václav Klaus, President of the Czech Republic. President Klaus was trained originally as an economist and as a professor of finance at the University of Economics in Prague. And it was as an economist that he first visited Cornell for a semester back in 1969. That was a tumultuous time for both our countries and actually for Cornell as well, but particularly for Czechoslovakia. He came then at the invitation of Cornell economics professors George Stoller and Jaroslav Vanek. President Klaus has been a major figure in Czech and European politics since the Cold War. He served as Minister of Finance and Vice Chairman of the Government for the Czechoslovak Federal Republic, Prime Minister of the Czech Republic, actually during the period when Czechoslovakia split, the Velvet Divorce, and Chairman of the Chamber of Deputies in the Czech Parliament. In 2003, he was elected President of the Czech Republic, and he was re-elected in 2008. President Klaus has published over 20 books on general social, political, and economic themes, and he's been awarded international prizes and honorary doctorates by universities throughout the world. We're really honored to have him speak to us today, and particularly on this subject. His title is A Return to Cornell, Personal Remarks by the President of the Czech Republic. Please welcome back President Václav Klaus.
Thank you very much. Dean LaPage, ladies and gentlemen, students, it's almost an adventure for the president of a small Central European country, the Czech Republic, to be back at Cornell after more than 41 years. It has been a long time since I was here last time, but the campus and the landscape around still look quite familiar to me, but many differences are quite visible. Just the autumn colors are different from those I could enjoy here in the spring of 1969. Since the fall of communism, I have been to the United States 50 to 60 times, but I did not get the chance to come here. So thank you for the invitation. I have been looking forward to it. When I heard that this lecture is Friday afternoon, and when I saw the incredible weather, I expected that no one would be here. So I am absolutely shocked. I don't know what it means. There must be probably an important speaker today, this afternoon. So thank you very much for being here. Let me start by looking back and by saying a few words about the time I happened to be here. It was not an accident that I was able to come in at that particular period of time. The political and economic reforms carried out in my country in the second half of the 1960s, which culminated in the well-known Prague Spring of 1968, opened up a unique, yet very narrow and short window of opportunity for the Czechs and Slovaks, and made it possible, among other things, to travel to the West and even to study there. I was lucky to be able to use this opportunity to be there at that specific point in time. I came here at the invitation of a Czech-born, now late, Professor George Stoller. I'm quite happy that his wife, Dorothy, is with us tonight, today. George Stoller from the Department of Economics in the College of Arts and Sciences to spend the spring term of 1969 as his teaching assistant. I did some teaching, but I used my stay here mostly for studying, for attending various courses in the field of economics, and especially for looking around in an attempt to better understand this great, and for us especially at that time, almost uncritically admired country. I came here from communist Czechoslovakia shortly after the country was occupied by the Soviet Union and other Warsaw Pact countries, which occurred, as some of you may know, in August 1968. It is an irony of history that the invasion of Czechoslovakia was the only military act done by the Warsaw Pact countries and armies at all. The Moscow politicians decided to do it because they rightly understood that we wanted to get rid of communism, and I am convinced that that fear motivated them to do it. As a result of it, we lost another 20 years, many of us the best years of our lives. This act and its consequences led to a feeling of deep frustration, which lasted in my country until the ultimate fall of communism in the year 1989. But the beginning was the worst. By a coincidence, I left Prague at the end of January 1969, only a day after the very sad and despairing funeral of the Czech student, maybe some of you come across the name, Jan Palach, who burned himself to death at the center of Prague in protest against the Soviet occupation of the country. It was an unheard of act, especially in the relatively mild and unexalted Central European civilizational setting. It has become part of our history and will never be forgotten. To leave Prague at that moment was fascinating, a sort of relief. I hoped I had come to a quiet campus with an ivory tower atmosphere. I hoped I had come to a country where politics is not omnipotent and omnipresent. I had hoped I had come to a country where students are supposed to study and professors to teach. Something we were deprived of during those years. But that was not what I found here. I came to a country in the era of SDS, you still know the acronym, Students for Democratic Society. I came to a country of Hare and Aquarius, of Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, of Flower Children, of Berkeley's People's Park protests, etc. Short time after my arrival, the black students here at Cornell occupied Willard Strait Hall for the first time at a university campus with rifles, and Cornell made headlines in the national media. I must confess, I had the feeling it was not much more quiet here than in Prague at that time. And I must say that some of the views and arguments used by the radical students here sounded quite familiar and quite alarming and dangerous. In spite of being from a communist country, I was here at that moment of history, ideologically firmly on the right. I happen to be here also in the moment of a fundamental dispute in the economic theory, and especially in economic policy, between monetarism and Keynesianism. And I must say, more from sitting in the library today, I was reminded that it was the Olin Library, the name I forgot, of course. More from sitting in the library than from the courses I took, I left Cornell as a devoted monetarist. After years of living in an oppressive and inefficient communist society and economy, people like me had a built-in mistrust in the possibility of the state and government to successfully and productively control, direct, regulate, or plan the economy. That led to my lifelong preference for market failure rather than for government failure. I personally experienced in the communist era that the government failure is always much bigger and much worse. My using of the word always is deliberate. As a result of that experience of mine, I look at the current attempts to fight the financial and economic crisis here and elsewhere with the same eyes. That's why I am more afraid of the consequences of the measures used to mitigate the crisis than of the crisis itself. I will talk about it also tomorrow at the UN General Assembly meeting in New York City. When I left Cornell and returned home in June 1969, the country was different than when I left it less than 5 months before. The communist regime, strengthened by the presence of the Soviet soldiers, succeeded to tighten its overwhelming control over our personal lives, an example of which was my dismissal from the Institute of Economics of the Czechoslovak Academy of Sciences after being labeled a leading non-Marxist economist of the country. On the one hand, it was a nice and flattering title, but on the other, it very much complicated my life in the following 2 decades. My Greyhound trip from Ithaca to the New York City and to the Kennedy Airport was my last touch with American soil for the next 20 years. I was often invited to speak here in America and in many other countries. The return to America. There is not much to say about these years now, and I'm afraid that nobody cares. Sovietology is completely out of fashion now. After our Velvet Revolution in November 1989, we started a process of a radical dismantling of all kinds of communist institutions and of building a pluralistic parliamentary democracy and market economy. We did not want to reform communism. We wanted to get rid of it. We were not flirting with various third ways. As the first post-communist minister of finance, I was in charge of the economic side of the transformation process. It was a fascinating challenge. Because of that, in the first half of the 1990s, our experience was an interesting topic, and I was often invited to speak here in the United States of America and in many other countries all over the world about this unique metamorphosis, about the transformation of the whole political, social, and economic system. But that's also all over now, and the interest has rightly shifted to other topics. In a relatively short period of time, the Czech Republic has become a full-fledged political democracy and market economy, member of NATO and of the European Union. We consider it a success. We can proudly claim to be a normal European country again. As a result, we already face standard European problems, not problems of a post-communist society. There are certainly easier to live with, but are more serious than we expected. We were dreaming of introducing American-style capitalism, but have been step by step, together with our preparations for the EU membership, importing the European model of an overregulated welfare state, which is neither a very productive nor a progressive or a dynamic system. That's not all. The European socio-economic model, the so-called, I think the German expression is better, soziale Marktwirtschaft, social market economy, is not the only problem we face. After half a century of communism, we wanted to be a free, sovereign, independent country again, but we became a part of a very dominant and more centralized European Union itself instead. Originally, in the 1950s, the European integration was based on the concept of intergovernmentalism. But in the last two decades, it turned into supranationalism, with the autonomy of individual member states probably smaller now than in the American Union. This is not what I wanted, and I am glad not to be alone in this position, neither in my country nor in Europe. Rather than being pushed into a position of being a European, which is something I don't authentically feel, I prefer to remain a Czech. But making such a simple and innocent statement is not politically correct in Europe these days. You are immediately considered an anti-European. My last point. Having been deprived of freedom for half a century, we are sensitive, if not oversensitive, when it comes to freedom, and react quite strongly and rapidly to all the slightest symptoms of its endangering. For that reason, we are nervous to see various new isms emerging around us, isms which become more relevant now than the forgotten and already almost no one inspiring old communism. The one I consider particularly dangerous today is the ideology of environmentalism, and especially its extreme variant, the global warming alarmism. That's why I wrote a book on this topic several years ago entitled Blue Planet in Green Shackles, with the subtitle What is Endangered, Climate or Freedom? My answer to this question is clear and straightforward. Freedom is endangered. Climate is okay. The book has been already translated into 16 languages, and I will be pleased to give it in English to your library, Mr. Dean, if you want. To be here after such a long time, a relevant question would be, which of my views and to what extent have been shaped or influenced by my stay here in Ithaca? It is difficult to say. I came here already as an adult, not as a teenager. But I can argue with conviction that I had been very productively using what I had learned here for many years which followed, and that the whole stale here, studying and meeting co-students and professors, was a great experience for me. I learned a lot. I have not had the chance to say thank you yet, so I do it now. And thank you for your attention. Thank you. Thank you.
We'd love to do some questions. If people would like to come up and line up behind the microphones here and here and up there. I guess there's only one up there. Do you have a question? Right, we can start right here.
Oh, yeah. Mr. President, thank you for coming to back to Cornell. We appreciate it greatly. I guess my name is Ray Mensah, and I am a senior in the ILR school. I would like to thank you for your leadership on several issues, including fighting what is being pushed down our throats on issues like the climate change and some other issues, because far too often we have a one-sided conversation, and that's even reflected here on this campus on this issue, in the classroom and other settings. And like you found yourself when you were here, often learning more in the library books, you know, I often do find myself learning more about some issues, not in the classroom, but on my own, doing my own research. So thank you for everything that you're doing. Thank you.
That was an easy question.
Yes.
Hi. Hello, Mr. President. My name is Aaron Donato. I'm a natural resources major. In reference to environmentalism, as he was talking about, do you really feel that the actions that people take, if they're acting in an environmentally conscious way, are dangerous? And do you feel that people are being forced to make decisions as simple as riding a bike or taking the bus as opposed to a personal vehicle?
Thank you for the question. And now I have a problem, because for me the climate change, global warming is a topic, and I have one speech after another all over the world. So to expect that this is the issue, I would have prepared a speech about global warming, not about my recollections coming back to Cornell. So I don't want to trivialize it with a short answer. You know, on the one hand, the issue is whether really there is some sort of global warming or not. That's a technical issue, and I'm not a climatologist. Probably there has been in the last 10,000 years some very small warming trend. The real issue is whether such a trend is a catastrophic phenomenon, and I would say no. The other issue is how much is it influenced by man, and especially by one variable, CO2 and its emissions. And third question is, even eventually, if it is so, can we do anything with it? And around those three questions or answers, I would speak for 2 hours if you let me. But it's not necessary. It looks like global warming outdoors now. I agree. It's when I remember the spring of 69 here in Ithaca, it was rather cold. So what I am afraid of is that the idea of some small warming was taken by politicians, by business lobbies, by such people, and it was stolen, more or less. And I am afraid that, and this is the subtitle of my book, What is Endangered? I really don't think that the climate is endangered. The climate fluctuates for millennia, centuries, and much longer periods. And what is endangered is freedom, because the environmentalists and Al Gore and all those people are telling us what to do, how to live, what to eat, how to behave, and many other things. And we are very sensitive to those issues. So that's my approach. So my book is more or less... Do we have a copy here, I'm sure? So Blue Planet in Green Shackles, it's more in the economics of global warming than climatology. So please, available.
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Edward Groden. I'm a first-year fellow at the Cornell Institute for Public Affairs. And I'm sorry to switch the topic a little bit here from environmentalism to the European Union. I actually study the European Union, and I was wondering if you could comment for a moment on your notoriety that you gained through your almost veto, essentially, of the Treaty of Lisbon, where you basically almost stopped it dead in its tracks until you eventually signed off on it. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on why the Czech Republic, first of all, joined the European Union in the first place.
Czech Republic, what? We don't, I don't understand fully. What's the question?
My question is about the Treaty of Lisbon.
The Treaty of Lisbon.
The Reform Treaty of the European Union. And you gained some notoriety in the European Union studies circles for almost stopping it. So I was wondering if you could comment, you said before about the centralization of Europe, and I was wondering, why would the Czech Republic join, from the Maastricht Treaty onward?
Okay.
So thank you.
So the EU. So yes. Why the Czech Republic joined the EU? You know, the Czech Republic is a country really in the very heart of Europe. So for us, there is definitely no way to be out of the overall European integration process. We were deprived of participating in it because of the communist putsch in February 1948, and I guess we would have been one of the founding fathers of the European integration process, being able to do it. So definitely for us, immediately after the fall of communism, The logical endeavor was to become, as I said, again, normal European country. And to be a normal European country these days means to be member of the European Union. So that's my first answer. Second answer is, on the streets in Prague in November 1989, in the time of the so-called Velvet Revolution, there were slogans, back to Europe, which was a logical attempt to be again a normal European country. I must say, I was the first who was trying to explain to the citizens of the country that back to Europe is not... And again, now I like the Italian term, back to Europe is not identical with the slogan Avanti into the European Union. I hope you understand this different. It was almost impossible to explain in the country. You can't explain it in short TV moments when you have one sentence and the sentence is interrupted in the middle. So we definitely had no other chance than to participate in this process. But the process has many tendencies, and now, as I try to say, that the Lisbon Treaty was the final moment of moving from the paradigm of intergovernmentalism to the paradigm of supranationalism. So this is something which I try to oppose, but being finally alone in Europe, so I was the last one who signed the treaty, and it works, I don't think, very successfully. Nevertheless, we are there, and there is no way to go on hunger strike or on something like that, you know. So you must be in already and try to influence something from inside, if possible.
Is there a question up in the balcony? Balcony?
Balcony.
Yes. Hi, Mr. President. My name is Maite Tapia. In your speech, you mentioned something about the crisis and how you're more afraid of the measures that will now come. But I wonder, to what extent is the crisis a result of those exact measures that were lacking?
Third lecture, economic crisis, you know, a totally different topic. Well, I think that everyone was surprised, shocked, when the crisis started 2 years ago. And everyone tried to explain it as a market failure, as a result of the bad functioning of the markets. It seems to me that now this is over. You know, the economists started to rationally explain what happened. We are witnesses of the great imbalances in the world economy, on the one hand. We know something about the wrong monetary policy of the Fed, of the American Central Bank. We know something about very low interest rates for an incredible period of time and for an excessive money supply. We know something about the irrational political playing with the mortgages, especially in this country. So all of that is not the market failure. All of this is the government failure, is the immodest and insensitive intervention of the government into the economy, at least in my understanding. So I don't think the crisis can be solved, mitigated, eliminated using the same policies as caused the crisis. So let's believe in the market and more than in the government. That's my suggestion, even for your country, I must say. You know, we were witnesses of an incredible government failure in the communist era. So our attempt after the fall of communism was to deregulate, liberalize, open up, desubsidize, privatize the economy. And now we see tendencies which go just the opposite, and I am nervous about that.
Let's take a question.
Thank you for coming to speak to us today, President Klaus. My question is about your experience here at Cornell. So coming at the time you did in 1968 from a country in which there was no freedom of expression, in which the people who had the guns could express themselves only, what was your impression of the black student takeover of Willard Straight Hall?
As I tried to say in my introduction, you know, it reminded me of the situation at home, and my many arguments with the radical students, members of the Students for Democratic Society. I had a feeling that I speak with the communist apparatchiks at home. You know, it was for me the structure of arguments, the way of thinking, the simplifications, and so it was something quite familiar to me. Nevertheless, it was one part of this great country, but at the time, something culminated even in this country, so it was a great experience for me.
Let's take a question. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. My name is Wei. I'm a freshman in the College of Arts and Sciences, and I'm an international student from China, which is still under the communist rule. So I'm just curious, I'm just wondering, do you see any merit in the communist system at all? And do you see anything in the Chinese communist system right now that's significantly different from the communist regimes, let's say in Europe, during the Cold War times? Thank you.
On the one hand, I wouldn't recommend anything to the Chinese political leaders, and I would say that it's their decision and the decisions of the people of China to choose a regime they want. On the other hand, I don't agree that communism in China was different from communism in other countries. That's definitely not true. We know that communism in China created tremendous disasters, human tragedies, enormous irrationality, and so on and so on. So I can say that the changes we witness in the last three, or I don't know how many decades, go in the positive direction, and we see the positive results, but no advocacy for communism from me, no.
Up in the balcony. Okay. Over here.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to us, Mr. President. My name is Katie. I'm a junior in the College of Arts and Sciences. I was wondering, what are your thoughts on steps that the European Union could or should take to restore sovereignty to, in at least some way, to the individual member states?
Well, I don't have a suggestion, and especially the point is that Europe does not want to do that. On the contrary, originally Europe and the European Union was an organization of individual member states. Now the leading slogan is, if some of you know it, Europe of Regions. But the slogan Europe of Regions is not an innocent, neutral statement. This statement says Europe of Regions, not of states. And whereas in the intergovernmental era of the European Union, the original building block of that institution was one individual member state. Now, in the supranationalistic European Union, the individual starting point is one person, one citizen, not states, not countries. This is an intentional change, and some of us who disagree with it are against it, but there is no way to recommend anyone what to do. The only way is to try to convince the people of Europe that it's a wrong strategy, and that we should rewrite our basic quasi-constitutions called the Lisbon Treaty.
Mr. President, thank you for coming back to Cornell. My name is Nick Shaler. I'm a junior in the ILR school. My question also is about European integration. Given the debt crisis in Greece, the regional tensions in Belgium, and the reemergence of nationalism in countries like Germany, where do you see the course of European integration going after this? Do you think it will continue on the same course, or do you think it will take a different form in the future?
Well, forecasting is difficult, so I don't know. Well, definitely the European politicians and the European elites have invested in the last decades already too much into such concept of Europe and such model of Europe as we see it now. So I on the one hand, I don't think that they are ready and willing to forget it and to start differently. On the other hand, this model has its internal intrinsic problems, conflicts. We see it probably most visibly this year in connection with the problems connected with the single European currency called the euro. So I am a diligent student of economics, so I, as some of the economic students here, I of course know the Robert Mundell's Nobel Prize laureate in economics from Columbia University, the Nobel Robert Mundell's theory of optimum currency areas. Some of you probably studied that concept here, and we all know that Europe or the current 16 Eurozone members do not create an optimum currency area. And according to the theory, when it is not an optimum currency area, the costs of keeping this area may be higher than the benefits it brings. So I am absolutely sure that the costs of creating a single currency for a very heterogeneous group of 16 European currency was a tragic mistake. Therefore, the Czech Republic is not part of the Eurozone. We are quite happy we have our own currency, the Czech crown. We are absolutely sure that it helped us to have our own currency in the current global crisis, because the exchange rate is a crucial economic variable. But it is a variable. If you, by creating a currency zone, if you turn the variable into a constant forever, you lost 1 degree of freedom in the system, and it must have consequences. And we saw, all of us saw the consequences this time. So we can say that the euro crisis started new round of serious debates in Europe about the future of Europe. Maybe it will lead to some change.
Do you think it might change?
Whether I think it might be changed, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It is quite clear mm-hmm. that you can't have a single currency. You can't have a currency union without fiscal union, and you can't have a fiscal union without a political union. So we witnessed a creation of one technically artificial political, fiscal, and monetary union next door. You know what I have in mind. I speak about Germany in the beginning of 1990s. The unification of Germany was, technically speaking, a creation of a monetary union. Yeah. But such a monetary union would not have existed one day without fiscal union, without huge fiscal transfers coming from West Germany to East Germany. So without those fiscal transfers, the German Union, called Germany, would have never survived a week or a month or something like that. This is usually underestimated, and I know the data, I know the figures, and I remember I was always speaking with the German politicians about that, and they said, well, it was necessary, there is inter-German solidarity, why not, which of course doesn't exist in Europe, mm-hmm. such a degree of solidarity as in Germany. And I remember I once had in my office the Chancellor of Germany, Schröder. You remember the Prime Minister before Angela Merkel. And we discussed this issue, and I told him, Mr. Prime Minister, the fiscal transfers every year it was some, now at that moment, some 12 years after the unification. Every year for 12 years, you sent to East Germany something like 140 billion euro before Marx. And he said, well, maybe even more. It's not visible from the statistics. The reality is even much worse. And then came my point. Mr. Prime Minister, you sent to East Germany every year, now for 15 years, something what's the size of the GDP of the Czech Republic. Every year. And I said, can you imagine that the citizens of the Czech Republic would have produced one GDP in 365 days, and then they got as a Christmas present another GDP? You know? Can you imagine that? But it was the only way how to create a really union, monetary union, based on two totally heterogeneous different entities. Schroeder říkal, I know the figure, but it never come to my mind that this is the size of the Czech Republic GDP. May I quote you permanently in Germany when I am attacked that we are not helping them enough? You know? So we know something about the costs of creating artificial monetary unions. And if I'm not wrong, I studied similar studies for many other countries in the world, and I know even some sophisticated studies discussing the title of one study. How long did it take the United States of America to create an optimum currency area? The optimum currency area was definitely not created in 1776 or 1778, as you remember. Mm-hmm. And the answer in that study published in the National Bureau of Economic Research, you can find the study there, the title, how long did it take? The answer was approximately 150 years, which means that before that time, some regions in the U.S. were suffering from having the same exchange rate and interest rates and monetary policy as some other regions. So a very difficult, serious issues, whereas in Europe, the idea of the common currency was considered a political project and stopped, without paying attention to the serious economic problems connected with it.
Let's have a question.
But I have topics for so many speeches here. I should return here because yes. Because I simplified too much. I simplified too much, I'm afraid.
Hi, President Klaus. My name is Stas Dorokov. I'm a junior in the College of Engineering. I was wondering if you could please elaborate on your Cornell experience. So you spent a spring here. So did you ever get a chance to go to any bars, the fraternity party? did you get to come to
bars?
Slope day? Were you here for Slope Day? I was wondering if you could elaborate on what you used to do in your free time.
Well, I try to study, I must say here, but of course, I had many meetings here, and what I enjoyed here, I hope it still exists. I know, I enjoyed very much because we are skiing country. I enjoyed very much going to the Greek peak for skiing. Does it exist? So that's something I remember quite well.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. My name is Felix Tabery. I'm from Paris, France, and I'm a freshman in the hotel school here. And I was wondering, because I was agreeing with you about your views on how the European Union is really crunching down the identities of individual countries, what options do the individual countries of Europe have to maintain their identity and to build upon their identity?
That in European countries. But it's interesting that that you are interested in the problems of the European Union here. That's surprising.
It's one world. Of course, this gentleman's from France, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. He's looking for pointers.
Well, you know that the so-called Maastricht Treaty created some conditions for countries which wanted to enter the Eurozone, and one of them was that there's a maximum 3% of GDP as a state budget deficit in a country. Well, when I heard it as Minister of Finance, when I heard it for the first time, I said, well, this is an irrelevant figure because I would never allow my country to have 3% deficit. It was in the 1990s, at the beginning of the 1990s. As you see, the world has changed, and if I look at US annual budget deficit, you know, it's very much higher, really, the problem, what is new, is that the disappearance of individual currencies simply helped to hide the debt problem in individual countries. So that's the new phenomenon. Greece having kept its own currency would have been punished because of its deficit already several years ago, but the Greek deficits and irrational behavior was not punished because it was hidden by means of not Greek drachma, but of the single currency of the euro. So that's the new phenomenon in Europe. So what to suggest, I don't know. I don't believe that the Eurozone would collapse and would be dismantled and the countries would return to their old currencies. This is not what I would expect, because as I said, the politicians invested already too much into the whole project. But what I expect that we will pay, we all of us in Europe and our children and grandchildren will pay a very heavy price in a sluggish economic growth. So that's my guess, that's my forecast for the future, and this forecast is not very pleasant for me.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hello, Mr. President. Thank you for coming to Cornell to speak with us this afternoon. My name is Nick Nevriker. I'm a second-year grad student in public policy. And I'd like to know about education in the Czech Republic. OECD studies show that the public education system is very good, actually much better than the U.S. on average. What would you say are the challenges that are facing secondary education and higher ed in the Czech Republic today?
Well, first, I on the one hand, I can say that those results are relatively flattering for us. You know, on the other hand, I don't believe in those international comparisons. Basically, it's so difficult to compare that I'm not absolutely sure that they are right. Well, there was a 300 years tradition of relatively very good education in my country. We can say that it was not totally destroyed. We were lucky that it was not totally destroyed in the communist era, especially at the level of primary and secondary education. I had at home a very, very good experience. After 1968, many Czechs and Slovaks emigrated to many countries in the world, many of them definitely here. And we happened to have at home a very nice experience, almost a controlled experience, which normally doesn't exist. My sister emigrated 5 days after the Soviet Union forces came to Czechoslovakia, emigrated to Switzerland. And my wife's sister emigrated to Great Britain and then to Australia. So we almost had a controlled experiment, three families, we had two children and they both have three children, three in Switzerland, three in Australia, and two in the Czech Republic. Almost a controlled experiment. You know, I would really insist that the level of education at that time in Czechoslovakia was seeing the children was really better than in those two other countries. And I know many complaints about the situation in your country, but we have the feeling that our universities are not that good as in your country, but I quite follow your debates, permanent debates about how to improve the quality of the American education. I don't know what to say.
One argument that's sometimes made about American universities is that the independence from government control has been a big factor.
But the political correctness at American universities is already decreasing the quality of education here, I would say.
Let's do up in the balcony.
Hello, Mr. President. Thank you for coming. My name is Matthew Rosenspire. I'm a sophomore in the School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And I would just like to ask, as leader of a country that was formerly behind the Iron Curtain, what do you make of the emerging policy of Russian reassertion, especially in light of the 2008 war in Georgia, and also the change in policy on American missile defense?
I, as a president of a country who will be sitting next to the president of Georgia and Russia tomorrow, you know, I don't want to make strong statements about individual cases. My general remark is that the political, social, and economic system in Russia is definitely different than the political, social, and economic system in the United States, America, or in the Czech Republic. And I would say that yours and ours is better than theirs. That's sentence number one. But sentence number two, you know, look at it in a historic perspective. Russia, with its history in the past centuries, 70 years of communism. So for me, what has been done in Russia is a surprise, almost a miracle, and we all of us expected that it would have been much, much worse. So I am not the one who demonizes Russia, and I think it's necessary to look at this country with rational, with normal open eyes, and to speak about real issues, not about a priori statements. I have to face that in my country and in some other European countries permanently, but I permanently try to tell them, please, this is not the time now to fight Mr. Brezhnev and communism. Let's take Russia as it is now, and don't trivialize the issue. So that's my general comment, not specifically commenting on one issue or another.
Okay, when you see Mr. Medvedev, you can tell him I meant no offense.
What did he say? If you see them tomorrow, he didn't mean offense. We'll do two more questions. One here.
Hello. My name is Michael Siegel. I'm a graduate student in the chemistry department here. My question actually ties in closely to what the previous question asked. And I guess maybe just to set it up, after the Second World War, the U.S., by virtue of its very large military, sort of fell into an international role where it provided somewhat of a security umbrella for much of the world, including Europe. now that people have said that it has provided benefits for much of Europe, it allowed them to be free of building up their own militaries to some extent and investing in their own social welfare states. And now today, it's looking like the U.S. may not be able to afford to offer such an umbrella as universally as it once did before. So my question is, what do current European leaders expect of America in the 21st century?
What do European leaders expect from America and the military?
In the 21st century.
Well, again, it's too big a question, you know, to ask what to expect in the 21st century.
Well, how about in 2011?
You know, for us, we consider still crucial to have NATO. That's one important sentence. There are tendencies in Europe to build the European defense and to somehow to marginalize the role of NATO. There are such tendencies. So our position is very strongly, don't duplicate NATO. Let's keep this as the one organization of that kind. And for us, the transatlantic relationship is an absolutely crucial thing. So this is what I expect from the United States of America, and I don't want to weaken or somehow to make this relationship weaker than it used to be in the past. That's my ambition and my only interest. It would be wrong for us, America, to close again and to concentrate either on domestic policies only or on some other continent. So we wish to keep the transatlantic relationship very strong. This is a general answer for me.
I'm going to do one last question here, and then we have a reception afterwards.
Hi, Mr. President. Thank you for being here. I have a philosophical question. And you said our freedom is in danger. But don't you think too much freedom of choice and option paralyze us from making the right decision and make us more unhappy and discontent? So my question is, like, what is freedom and how do we use freedom correctly?
Well, first, I think the question is wrong.
It's wrong? Okay.
You should return to the first class here, and of freedom can't be used. Freedom is not for using. Simply, freedom is or freedom is not, and it's your decision how you use your freedom. So don't speak about using freedom. It reminds me in the communist era when the central planning didn't function, they wanted to use markets. You know, it's a total nonsense. You can't use markets. You can let markets function, but use them as an instrument in your hands. Freedom is not an instrument in our hands. Simply, I am happy. I am free to choose, and I think this. This is the main answer, I think, which is appropriate. Nothing else. And it's up to you how you yourself personally use the freedom, whether you go to the bars here in Ithaca or whether you go to your great fitness center. I was shown this morning. It didn't exist here 41 years ago. At that time, we went to the Bartlett Hall to play basketball, I remember. Now you go to the fitness center. This is wrong. This is a very left. This is a very leftist, dangerous idea.
Thank you very much. That was superb.